Congratulations to many of you. You made it through the first day. I'm sure at times you had all types of ideas. Probably moments of thinking, maybe this wasn't such a great idea after all. And maybe the exact opposite. Maybe moments of feeling really connected and feeling like this is the right place to be. But all that's gone now, isn't it? It's all just gone. So now what? So tonight I want to talk about waking up. What does it mean to wake up? What is the awakening process? In fact, the word Buddha just means to be awake. That's all it means. It's gotten, over the years, thousands of years, it's gotten to be so religified, of course, and we have terms like enlightenment, and the Buddhist experience, or the awakening experience, has become very mystified, I think. And I know for me, over the years, practicing meditation, it has also felt very unattainable at times. I think of it as, we had a new, I don't know if you guys are into Star Wars, but we just had a new Star Wars movie come out in America, and it was actually really good. I grew up with Star Wars. And sometimes I feel like the Dharma in awakening is very much like Star Wars. Like it's a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, there were people who were happy. And sometimes it can take on this striving quality where it just feels like such a distant thing. So I want to try to shift that paradigm a little bit this evening, because it's actually, nothing could be farther from the truth. And that waking up is what the Buddha did. He woke up to the way things are. He woke up to the issue at hand. He woke up to really what it means to be human, what it means to be here. And so one thing I want to say is don't underestimate the value of your own dissatisfaction. Because that is usually the catalyst, and that usually is the motivation for how we end up traveling to a place like this in the first place. You know, how did you get here? What is it that you're looking for? One of the questions I sit with often is, when did it all go wrong anyway? And what can be done? And for most people, I think, maybe not everybody, but I think most people end up coming to a practice like this one, coming to mindfulness or meditation or Buddhism or Dharma or whatever was the door that you came through, because you saw on some level that life wasn't really maybe going how you thought it was supposed to go. Things didn't work out the way you thought they were supposed to work out. Maybe you felt tricked or disappointed or let down, or maybe you did all the right things. You did all the right things you were taught. You went to the right school and got the right job and followed all of the rules that your culture told you to follow, and you didn't get what you wanted, or it didn't turn out exactly how you hoped it would. And that's a good thing to see that. That's a good thing to see that, because what that does, what that did for me in a very big way, the dissatisfaction for me came in many forms, but I think the big one was that what I was looking for and what I was trying to get or have actually isn't out there. It's not out there. Because I can give you many examples of how I had a goal and I did something and I was a successful musician and lived in lots of great places and did lots of things that I wanted to do. But all of the things that I wanted to do, once I achieved them, it didn't really pan out. It didn't provide the happiness that it promised. And so really from a Buddhist angle, or really we could say a reality angle, there actually is no out there. There's just your experience. There's just what's happening. Sometimes that even can be a little bit dissatisfying. But I think what happens is we come to meditation and we get it all backwards. We have everything is sort of upside down on us. And I know that for me, and that most of the people that I work with in the practice, we have this notion that if I just meditate properly and regularly and diligently, if I really, really do this task, that something's going to happen, right? There's going to be some event. There's going to be some aha moment. There's going to be some big breakthrough, some big enlightenment, some amazing experience is going to happen. And then on the other side of that experience, everything's going to make sense. There's going to be no more pain, no more disappointment. I'm going to understand the true nature of things and radiate loving kindness inward and outward in all directions. And if I could just do it right, if I could just practice diligently, that something's going to happen, and then boom. That's backwards. That's not how it is. At least I haven't gotten there yet, and I haven't met anybody else who has. So it's not this sort of trudging the hard road and, you know, hoping it works out at some point. There's no real destination or goal. There's nowhere to go anyway. In fact, truth be told, what we're trying to do is to get back here. Did anybody have a hard time following the breath today? Right? So hard. It's so hard to come back to here. We're not trying to go anywhere. We're trying to get back to now, to here, to now. And so if we're trying to wake up, we probably want to talk a little bit about what is the experience of being asleep. What is sleeping? And if we really sit and we get really honest with ourselves and we really can get into some sort of place where we can literally see the mind for what it is and see what it's up to. I know that I'm constantly in awe and to some degree have a very healthy level of respect for how much trouble my mind can get me into. I mean, I can literally be sitting here right now in the middle of the woods in northern Thailand convincing myself that, you know, my life in Los Angeles is just not going to work out. I mean, I can trip hard in my mind, sitting here in this empty building. Anybody trip hard today? Anybody go to some very interesting places? Did any of that actually happen today? Nothing that you thought was going to happen today happened today. None of it happened, or at least not yet. And how convincing was it? so convincing. You are asleep. Into this imagination, mental proliferation. Just actually really quite awesome thing called the mind. The psychedelic acid trip of life. Sometimes I just feel like, I actually feel like I'm tripping right now because I actually shouldn't have meditated as much as I did with you guys today because I'm really spaced out. I've been warned by my teachers. Noah always warns me. He says, you sit too much on when you teach retreats. He's like, you're going to get spaced out. And so again, if we really sit and watch this thing, it's just constantly trying to bring in, pulling in what's wanted, pulling in what would be good for me, what would be a good plan, what would be a good choice, what would be pleasant. It's constantly pulling in what it wants and constantly pushing out what it doesn't want. Gotta have this, gotta get rid of that. Do this, make that plan, do this thing, that will be good. Get rid of this, get rid of that, that's not good. It's just this, constantly. And this is just the nature of mind. This is just biological, survival, ancient lizard brain mentality. Has been with us for, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of years. But we also now have this amazing thing called our prefrontal cortex, which is another part of the mind, which is really the part of the mind that we want to develop, where the mindfulness is developed. And so we see, and the Buddha pointed this out very clearly, that what the experience of being asleep is being driven by greed, hatred, and delusion. The greedy aspect of the mind, the wanting part of the mind, that's pulling in, imagining and thinking about and pulling on all the things that I should get and have and become. And if I could get, have, and become all the things that I think I should get, have, and become, then I'll be happy forever. And the hatred of the mind, the aversive that says, these are the things I need to get rid of. I need to stop being like this. I need to stop being like that. I need to get rid of this. I need to get rid of that. If I get rid of all the things that need to go, I'll be happy forever. And if you watch and you sit and watch, this happens sort of all by itself, doesn't it? You don't really have to put much energy into that. You can watch it. And the delusion of that is, the delusion or the confusion is we think that if we were able to do it and to pull it off, that it would actually work. Not only is the task completely impossible, but even if you pulled it off, there'd still be just more of that. And also this is another way that the Buddha talks about samsara. This is the conditioned realm. And so we fall asleep into that over and over and over again. We wake up and we fall asleep and we wake up and we fall asleep and we wake up and we fall asleep. And waking up is not much different than waking up in the morning. The alarm goes off and you get up and you think, oh man, I don't want to wake up. Something about this sleepiness, the delusion, it has a pleasantness to it at times. Because waking up to the reality of our lives sometimes is painful. We don't really want to do that. And so as we practice here, we maybe find out some things or we learn some truths that we would prefer not to be true. And we might choose to go back to sleep. So if you get this, if you follow me, if you see this is the sudden awakening. It's immediate. It's just, it turns out there is something wrong. It turns out you are right. There's something not quite right about this experience. And then we wake up to that, and then we start to do strange things, like think that might be a good idea to sit quietly in a room all day and pay attention to my breathing. maybe that will do me some good. Right? Because we see, we wake up to the reality of what the mind is and how it works, and we think to ourselves, well, there's got to be a better way. There's got to be another way to go about this life. There's got to be another way to operate. And so, to some degree, if you've come all the way here and you're practicing, you already know that. You already know. And now we do this, the process of continuing to wake up. And we do this, as I talked about today, this gradual, slow cultivation of qualities. And we're cultivating awareness through mindfulness practices. We're cultivating the ability to see things more clearly. We are cultivating the ability to wake up. And you woke up and fell asleep probably thousands and thousands and thousands of times today. And even from the philosophical and psychological paradigm of the Buddhist endeavor, is that you wake up and you fall asleep, and you wake up and you fall asleep. You don't just wake up and stay woken up. Again, it's not an event that occurs and I'm just awake now. But the more we cultivate awareness and the more time we put into practicing, we get to spend more of our lives awake and less of our lives asleep. And the timetable continuum just grows. And this is also what they're seeing in modern neuroscience around mindfulness practices, is that this theory that short moments repeated become continuous. You know, you can pay attention to 3 breaths, and then you can pay attention to 7 breaths. And before you know it, you can pay attention to your breath for minutes. So these short moments repeated become continuous. So even though it might have felt tedious at times today, the cultivation of awareness that you're getting, it doesn't go back. It's you're kind of storing it in some kind of mindfulness storage bank. And so there's no wasted time here. Although your mind probably told you a few times, maybe, that this is a waste of time. And so we spoke yesterday, I spoke last night about taking refuge, and I want to talk a little bit about what the Dharma is. And so we understand that this word Buddha just means to wake up, and that we all have the potential and the capacity to wake up. It's something that can be done. And then we take refuge in this idea of the Dharma, that there's something to wake up to. And likewise, as I just mentioned, there's also something to wake up from. And so just to give you a little bit of maybe backstory on the Buddha himself, is he was no different than any of us. He was dissatisfied with the world at his time and dissatisfied with the reality that nobody seemed to have an answer to birth, old age, sickness, and death, and suffering, essentially. And there were many people who were practicing different meditation practices at his time, different spiritual practices, meditation, prayer. The Upanishads were around at the time. With India, there was lots of ideas floating around at the time. And he practiced many of them and was very unsatisfied. And said, this is not what I'm looking for. And it wasn't until he, what seems to be out of his own frustration, sat quietly under the tree that night and just looked at the experience that he was having in a very almost scientific way, looking right at the psychology and the existential psychology of what is my mind doing. And then he developed this whole system called the Dharma. And so sometimes the Dharma is referred to as what the Buddha taught. The teachings of the Buddha are often called the Dharma. The way things are, sometimes it's translated as the way things are, the truth of things. It's actually a fairly impossible term to translate. But I can tell you what the Buddha said about the Dharma. There's one of my favorite texts, or one of my favorite teachings in the canon, is a text called The Noble Quest. And it's a interesting, it's written very interestingly because it's very rare in the way that it's written. Most of the teachings, most of the suttas that we hear about and learn about is the Buddha are in conversation. So essentially, you know, somebody comes and sits down with the Buddha and asks him a couple questions, and he answers the questions, and they have a dialogue. So a lot of the teachings are in dialogue. A lot of the teachings are the Buddha giving a talk like this, where he's telling or talking to a group of people, and they might have some questions. But in this one particular teaching, the Buddha is actually having a conversation with himself in his own mind. And it starts off and he says, "I considered," so we get the sense of he's thinking about what happened. He says, "I considered this Dharma that I have reached, this Dharma that I have attained." And he says, "This Dharma that I have reached is very difficult to see." He says, "It's quiet, it's excellent. It can't be attained by logic and reason. You can't think your way into it." He says, "It's sensed and felt only by the wise." He says, "It's subtle." And he also says, "It's only available here and now." And then he goes on to say some more interesting things. So he's talking about that what we're looking for and the lens that we're trying to see experience through is very much right here, right now, all the time, but it's really hard to see. And he says it's very difficult for people to see this Dharma because they delight and revel in their place. And he says that they delight and revel in their place to such a degree that they cannot see the ground. And so he's talking about how do we make this shift from being preoccupied with a place to seeing the ground that we're living from. And the word place, I know, is a very, very generic term, but what he's saying is that we're so preoccupied with what we're going to do, what we're going to be, what it was like in the future, what's it going to be like in the future, what was it like in the past, when am I going to be happy? What am I going to do when I leave New Life? And we're so preoccupied with, to some degree in the modern world, our status in the world, my job, my relationship status, my career, who am I? We are so preoccupied with a sense of a destination, a sense of a final goal attainable, be something, become something. That's what I'm going to do. That's my place. Need to get there. And where so much of our thinking, so much of our life, so much of our time and energy is totally consumed into this place that we need to be at, because when we get there, we'll be happy, right? And we'll be happy forever. And there'll be no more disappointment and loss and confusion. That'll all be gone. And get rid of all that. He says we're so preoccupied with this that we're looking right over the Dharma. We're looking right past what's right here in front of us. And he says that because we are so preoccupied and so clinging and grasping and thinking about and trying to create this perfect person, trying to create this self that we feel okay with, that we don't see the ground. And sometimes he calls it in the Buddhist teachings, it's called dependent origination, or the conditioned karma, that there, to some degree, he says, we don't see the cause and effect of it all. We don't see that there's causes and conditions to everything that happens. And so how do we make a shift from this place, being preoccupied with a place becoming somebody, to actually really sitting into and feeling into the ground? And he says that people are, our consciousness is dyed like a, you would dye a cloth. We're dyed into craving and aversion and greed and hatred. And we are like a mass of darkness. And we can't wake up because we're so enamored in trying to satisfy this place that we need to get to, this destination that we want to arrive at so badly. And then it's also one of the places in the canon where he uses the term against the stream. He says, we do not see what goes against the stream. And the stream essentially is the stream of consciousness, the pulling and pushing that I mentioned, that is the greed, the hatred, and the delusion. That's the stream we're going down. And the Buddha is asking us to stop slowly and turn back and look at the stream and go a different way. And then he goes on to say in the sutta, he says he's thinking about this and he surveys the world and he looks out at the world and he's trying to think if he wants to teach. He's like, am I going to teach this Dharma that I have reached? Am I going to teach human beings that there's another way to do this? And he says his mind inclined towards not teaching. He looked at the world and he looked at people and he looked at how they behaved and acted and how preoccupied they are with their place, and he just thought to himself, this is not going to go down. Nobody is going to do this. Nobody is going to be willing. And he said that people have too much dust in their eyes. And then the story goes on. I, this is where it gets to be a little strange, and I don't necessarily believe the actual story because a lot of it is mythological, but some gods sort of came down from wherever gods come down from, and some deities and gods actually talked the Buddha out of it. And they said, no, you should totally teach. And he said that actually out of compassion for the world, and that he did consider this notion. He said, well, maybe there'll be some people. And the term is, he says, there'll be some people who have just a little bit of dust in their eyes, and they'll be willing to do this hard work of waking up. And I'm glad he made that choice. And I think it's very interesting and quite profound that 2,600 years later, people are still making the choice to give this a shot. And so even though we might only have a little bit of dust in our eyes, but I don't know if you've ever had dust in your eyes, but even one piece of dust feels like a lot. You ever just try to, you know, so it's a painful, at times confusing process, this waking up business. And then in another sutta, the Buddha talks about the Dharma being visible, this visible Dharma, available only here and now. Only right here, only right now. And he says to one of his students, Vachagoda, he says, let be the past. Don't worry about the past. Don't worry about the future. I will teach you this Dharma. And he says that this Dharma is visible, meaning that you can see it. It's immediate, meaning that it's just really, just literally right here. It's inviting. It draws us in, has a welcoming, invitational, meta quality to it. It's uplifting. It's encouraging. It's inspiring. And it's experienced only by the wise. It's felt only by those who incline their awareness in just the right kind of way. And also, ironically, this experience of Dharma, this experience that we're looking for, it doesn't require us to be a Buddhist. It doesn't have any of that connotation to it. In fact, I'm sure that many of us, I know that for me, even before I learned meditation, even before I even knew there was a thing called mindfulness, we've all had experiences in our life where we felt connected to something, don't we? Whether you're in nature, listening to music, going for a hike at the beach, we've all had those moments, right, where you're just somewhere and for some reason you kind of snap into this sense of like, oh, this is good. You feel connected or whatever the experience is. Maybe you took a whole bunch of LSD and you were just really feeling like one with the universe or whatever it is, right? We've all had those kinds of experiences. So when we hear some of this stuff, it doesn't sound that far-fetched to me. It doesn't sound like a mystical galaxy far, far away adventure. It's a very immediate, very practical, very available sense. And I believe and have experienced this Dharma as being very ordinary. Very ordinary. It's a just way of being, a way of seeing. And you've probably had many, many glimpses of it today. And then we fall back asleep and then we wake back up. And so he also says in this sutta, in many places in the canon, this term that I love so much called ahipasako, which is a term that translates as come and see for yourself. Where all of the teachings of the Buddha, when he was even questioned, and people would say, well, why should we believe you? The Buddha would give a talk and people would say, well, we have these spiritual teachers come through here all the time. And they're all saying that they have the truth. Why should we believe what you have to say? And he said, you totally shouldn't believe what I say. You shouldn't believe what anybody says. You should come and see for yourself. You should come and see. You should come and have a seat. Ahipasako, come and take a look for yourself and see if you can see if this is true or not for you. And so it's an invitation that's part of the Dharma. It's inviting. It's uplifting. It draws us in. I almost feel like when I practice with people and I love sitting and practicing retreats and teaching my weekly classes because there's almost a contagiousness of it. The Dharma feels like it's contagious. And so we get drawn in and we get drawn in. And we come and we see. And in this particular sutta where he talks about the Dharma being visible and immediate and uplifting, he asks the question, do you know when you have greed in your mind? Do you know when you have hatred in your mind? Do you know when you have delusion in your mind? And also, do you know when those things aren't present? Do you know when there's no greed in your mind? Right. And I know that I oftentimes am looking for it, but I don't sit and appreciate the absence of it. Have you ever sat in meditation and thought to yourself, oh, I'm not angry right now. There's no anger in my mind right now. This is great. So great to have a not angry mind. Right? You ever sit and think to yourself, there's no greed in my mind, there's no wanting, there's no lust, there's no clinging. I'm so happy to sit here with no clinging in my mind. No confusion. No delusion. No sitting here making plans about what I'm going to do when I leave or what I'm going to become, what I'm going to be when I grow up. I don't know if that story's ever going to stop. I've wanted to be so many things when I grew up. My current thing is I wanted to be a Dharma teacher when I grew up, and now I'm a Dharma teacher. And I'm like, I don't know if I want to be a Dharma teacher. Maybe I want to be something else. What do I want to be when I grow up? It's like, doesn't stop. And the Buddha said that. He said, yeah, that's going to happen. That's that preoccupation with this place. So we start to look at the ground. And the ground, actually, no big surprise, is mindfulness. Mindfulness is the ground. Mindfulness is the direct path to liberation. The word for ground in the Pali is called tanam. When he says we don't see the ground, we're preoccupied with a place, he says the ground that we want to see is tanam, idham, tanam, this ground, which is also the same word that we see in satipatthana, which is the teachings that we're practicing all week. Satipatthana, the four foundations of mindfulness. And we spent the whole day today working with this first instruction of mindfulness of breathing. That's a ground to live from. Mindfulness of breathing is a ground because, if you noticed, it was it immediate? Was it visible? Was it reliable? Is it available here and now? Yes, 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 right down the list. Is it inviting? Maybe not so much the breath, not that inviting, but maybe it was inviting at times. Uplifting. The Buddha, in his radical pragmatic thinking, brings us right into the direct experience of of being here, being with the breath. And so when we start to live from the ground, mindfulness becomes our biggest ally, because now we're seeing things more clearly. And even though you don't feel like it right now, you are all very, very concentrated. You might feel scattered, but the level of concentration, if I was to drop one of you off in like Bangkok right now, you'd totally freak out. You'd be like, you don't realize that you've been in the woods all day and hanging out and you have a degree of concentration. I can even get a sense of it just sitting here. So your awareness is really finely tuned. And the capacity for mindfulness is there. And mindfulness has two qualities that we're trying to capture. And the one is this knowing quality. In Pali, the term, anytime you see the letters NNA, nya, to know, so consciousness is vijnana, and to know. Mindfulness is about knowing, not knowing where you grew up, or knowing what day of the week it is, or knowing what country you're in, not that kind of knowing about things, but knowing the experience that you're having. Knowing that you're breathing in versus breathing out. Knowing that. So there's a whole set of skills around knowing. And then there's also these other set of skills that we spent some time with today, which we'll spend time with every day, is to care. Mindfulness has an empathetic quality to it. So we learn to know about things and we learn to care about things. We learn to know what's happening. We learn to sympathize or empathize with what's happening. And this is the congruency that brings the heart and mind together. We know what's happening, we care about what's happening. And if we get honest with ourselves, we often know what's happening, but we don't really care so much. Get rid of that, I don't like that. Shut that off. I don't want to think about that. I don't want to remember that. I don't want to feel that. Right? So we have to accompany the knowing with the caring. Otherwise, the hatred just swoops in and says, no, get rid of that, get rid of that, get rid of that, get rid of that, get that, have that. And at the core of all of this, and we see it right in the breath, is at the core of all this that we're looking with mindfulness to see what's often known as the three characteristics of existence. That there's three hallmarks to all experience. And this is part of where the ground actually becomes groundless. Right? When we think of a ground, I think of something solid, something that I can really put my feet on. But when we're looking at the ground of experience, the mind ground, the heart-mind ground, it's not that stable, actually, which is why it's so darn hard to see, because it's, first of all, it's moving a million miles an hour. And so the first thing that Buddha brings us to see, the ahipassaka, come and see, he says, come and see, do you notice things are anicca, things are impermanent. Everything is changing. Every experience you've ever had in your life, where is it now? It's gone. Everything that you've ever done is literally over. Right? Every difficult moment you had today is gone. Every pleasant moment you had today is gone. Of course, we call this the experience of gone. We call it the past. And we remember that things have happened, and oftentimes we drag the past into the present. But things are constantly changing, which really starts to undermine the strategy for being preoccupied with the place. Because when we really, and of course this is probably one of the themes in Buddhism that's the most easy to understand on a sort of logical, cognitive level. Yeah, we know things change. That's not a big insight. But isn't it? When a relationship that you really care about changes and ends, how much acceptance do you have? Right? When you lose a job that you really cared about, or somebody dies, or your animal pet dies. When we're faced with impermanence and the reality of loss, we don't really act so accepting of it, even though we know that things change. So on some level, you can know something and actually not know it at all. Right? If I know that things change and everything's changing, why are we grasping and clinging at everything? Wouldn't that not be very logical? No, we forget. We fall asleep. One of the big delusions is that we take impermanent experience to be permanent, and we just get our nails dug into it, and we have to have it. And then when the conditions fall away, when the thing goes, we suffer. We lose. We lose. We have loss. Part of impermanence is loss. And we notice that. And so this is why mindfulness of breathing is so interesting, because it's constantly changing. To be with experience is to be with change. It's just right there. And that sets us up for the next characteristic of all things. Everything is changing. Everything is anicca, and therefore everything is also dukkha. Everything is insubstantial, unreliable, difficult, unsatisfying. And again, as I said at the beginning of the talk, if you've noticed that about your life, we oftentimes fall into a depression about that, or we can become disappointed about that. But actually, that just means you're seeing things clearly now. If everything is changing, how can anything be stable and reliable? This can help us let go. It can help us let go, and it also can allow us to experience the arising of this compassion that we'll work on, and I spoke about a little bit today, is that when faced with change and faced with difficulty, the only real appropriate way to respond to that is to have compassion. For loss, for death, for disappointment, for the falling away of things. There's no really other way to handle that makes any sense when it comes right down to it. And even watching the breath change, being with the experience, the present time, you probably noticed there was some difficulty in that. It's so difficult. Life is not easy. This is not an easy thing to be in. And when it gets too hard, when the moment gets too hard, I need to change it, I need to control it, I need to avoid it. And then my mind switches on the delusion. My mind goes back to sleep and says, I'm just going to think about something else now. I'm just going to think about something. I'm going to get out of this experience. Until that thinking, planning, whatever little story you had going, that eventually ends too, doesn't it? And you realize you just spent 20 minutes thinking and you're still sitting in this room. You didn't get anywhere. None of this, you couldn't do any of the things you thought about doing, right? And then that sort of falls away. And so that one's also maybe a little bit easier to understand. Not easier, but things are changing. Because things are changing, it's going to make a mess of things. It's going to be difficult. And then that brings us to the experience of anatta, which is the experience of not self, which I'm oftentimes hesitant to mention because it sounds a little esoteric. But did anybody experience self today? Anybody have the experience of you? Right? Have you noticed what a pain in the ass it is to carry this thing called yourself with you everywhere you go? It shows up in every moment. Here I am. What's going on? What are we doing? So we're just going to sit here all day and do this? Really? That's why we came to Thailand, to sit quietly with our eyes closed in a building with weird noises? Cool. All right. If that's what you want to do, fine with me. I'm just going to hang out, I guess. Yeah. What do you think for lunch? I don't know. Something good, I hope. What are you doing now? Oh, you're breathing. Oh, okay, cool. Right on. How's that going? Right? It's like, there you are, jabbering away. Is that really you? Or is that just a thought? So the real paradox and the trick of all this is if you look, you can't find the self, but yet it seems to be everywhere you look. And so this is the experience of we take things personally. We make a story up, we make a narrative about it, we come up with reasons why we suffer around this experience of the self. And one of the things that's very interesting on an impermanent moment-to-moment basis, if you start to notice and you start to look, you'll see that the experience of self and your attitude about the self is completely related to how the moment feels. It's a very unreliable story. But the mind, for some reason, has this ongoing, because it's preoccupied with a place, and the place that you're most preoccupied with is actually you. The destination of Dave Smith, which I seem to arise in every moment. And then I have to give myself a little status update about how it's going. Be like, I don't know. You've made a lot of bad choices so far, and this is definitely one of them. And so the reason why we want to bring our attention to the breath and the reason why we want to learn how to tune into experience is we're trying to let go of the story. We're trying to let go of the narrative. It doesn't go anywhere. It just keeps, all it does is that. All the self knows how to do is to keep selfing. And whatever self I have in this moment, I play that out until that version of me dies and then it takes birth again and I have another self. How many yous did you experience today? How many versions of yourself did you experience? How many of them were really actually you? And the theme of suffering, if you look at the top 10 themes of suffering, I think the top of the list is always me. I suffer about me. In my place. And how I'm not in the right place. In the wrong place. The wrong time. There must be a better moment to be in. And you're not in it. And why not? Why did you get me in this unpleasant moment? Don't you care about me? I thought you liked me. Do you hate me? You hate me, don't you? Why would you fly me all the way over here? And then we just see this over and over and over again. And so to some degree, we're trying to break our addiction to that. We're trying to break our addiction to the mind and break our addiction to this story. And the best way to do that is to cultivate qualities. Don't be a self. Don't think about the person to be. Don't worry about your place. Be here. Be kind. You want to give the mind something to do? Give it that. Be with the breath. Be kind. Be gentle. Let the judgment go. Let the critical mind go. Let the planning mind go. You can let that go. That is not necessary. And you can learn to dwell and to abide and to rest and to wake up into the Dharma. Now, that also doesn't mean we need to abandon that sense of self. But if we look at the scales of the balance versus the self versus qualities, we usually find we're way out of balance because the self is really preoccupied with the greed, hatred, and the delusion. The self wants things for itself. It wants to get rid of things. And it thinks if you got rid of all the things you wanted to get rid of and got all the things you wanted, total happiness for you forever. Right? Do you have any evidence to suggest that that's going to happen? Have you ever gotten anything in your life that carried with it all the promises that it promised you? Has that ever worked ever one time ever? So why do you think the next train that you're going to jump on is going to take you to the right place? And the whole trick of the matter, the whole paradox of the Dharma is really what we're trying to do is we're actually trying to arrive into your life, which is happening right now. This is it. It's very ordinary. It's not necessarily anything special or mystical. Buddha enlightened, Buddha on the mountaintop, blissed out. Story that we've been told. No, it's about coming right into the direct experience. It's about being here and attending to the ground, cultivating. Right? When we attend, when we cultivate, it's a present time experience. We pay attention, we pay attention, we let go of the concepts and the ideas. We try to draw out the kindness, the compassion. And then what starts to happen, I've noticed for me over the years, is all of a sudden, the place that I want to be is often the place that I'm in. It's just kind of a nice shift when that happens. You're like, oh yeah, this will do. This moment will do. This moment will do quite fine, actually. This is pretty good. I like this. I can do this. You can do now. So again, the Dharma, this refuge, taking refuge in that, finding some degree of safety. the word that makes the most sense to me lately for refuge, is trustworthy. The present time experience right now, this is trustworthy. You can trust this. You can't trust what you're going to do in 2 weeks or what you did 2 weeks ago. You can't do any of those things. It's unreliable. So we start to see this, and we start to surrender. We start to let go. And we start to actually live the life that you're having, instead of trying to live the life that you're imagining you could be having, which you can never do. And I feel like oftentimes my life is on this like sort of slap back delay, where there's the moment that I'm in, and then my mind in its delusion always has this other moment that I could be in. Well, this is what's happening right now. But my mind's like, you know what could be happening right now? Check it out. You could be. Oh, I could be. Oh, that's so great. How do we do that? I want to do that. It's like, well, you should have listened to me. You should have did what I said. You wouldn't fucking come all the way over here and do this. This is ridiculous. How's that breathing going? You're like, oh, not so good, actually. What are we doing again? And it's just like, and it's always, I feel like it's a shell game. It's a con man. And so as we go through our lives, we're constantly having to navigate our way between what's really happening and what we think should be happening. And what's really happening versus what we think should be happening. And then there's the ground of really how it is. And then there's this place that's a little bit different than this ground. And we oftentimes distort the reality, and the delusion says that I somehow could have this. I could somehow do this place. And the Buddha very, very clearly, very articulately, through many times in the canon, and very much in this case, says, you don't see the Dharma. You don't see what's happening because you're preoccupied with this. You can't. You get sucked in. It sucks us in. It's like a vortex. And so if you notice that you're having that experience, this is not to be disappointing. This is exactly what the Buddha said is happening. But the question is, how do we learn to negotiate? Then how do we learn to trust that the place is really not available? And that the tragedy of the situation is that many people live their whole life in this, and they never get out of the matrix. They live and they die, and they never got to go there. And meanwhile, their whole life went right by them. They missed out on the whole thing. I missed my whole life because I was imagining how else it could have been. So as you consider some of these ideas, these are some of my thoughts and some of the ways that I have found approaching the practice to be helpful. And really the way that I currently hold this taking refuge in the Dharma and trusting and really learning how to trust what is. So I offer that for your reflection this evening. So let's just sit for a minute or two.